KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I've got a few things I want to say to this body. I tried to say them once before and I got stopped colder than a mackerel. Well, I'd like to get them said this time, sir. And as a matter of fact, I'm not going to leave this body until I do get them said.
President, will the Senator yield?
The Senator yields.
No, sir, I'm afraid not. No, sir. I yielded the floor once before, if you can remember, and I was practically never heard of again. No, sir. And we might as well all get together on this yielding business right off the bat now.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. We present talks by writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien, and that was Jimmy Stewart, of course. That's because on this week's forum, Ms. Warren goes to Washington. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, that is. She's on the road telling the story of her life and her vision of a progressive America. She's got a few things she wants to say, but rest assured, she'll yield for questions. Warren's talk comes at an opportune time, on the heels of last week's broadcast featuring Timothy Geithner. The two have had vocal Wall Street versus Main Street differences of opinion. Geithner has said, quote, "Her criticisms of the financial rescue, if well-intentioned, were mostly unjustified, and her TARP oversight hearings often felt more like made-for-YouTube inquisitions than serious inquiries." And Warren has faulted Geithner for, among other things, believing, quote, "Government's most important job was to provide a soft landing for the tender fannies of the banks." A debate would have been in order, but we'll have to settle for back-to-back presentations. Senator Warren's new book is A Fighting Chance. She spoke at University Temple United Methodist Church on May 29, 2014. University Bookstore sponsored the event.
So can you hear me okay? Everybody can hear me. Can you hear me in the back row? I want you to know I can see you in the back row. You can always tell a teacher, and I know why you end up in the back row. So I will be keeping an eye on you. There will be a quiz following this. No, it is fabulous to be here. I am delighted to be in Seattle. I am delighted, after so much time in the Senate, to be in front of a live audience. I appreciate the invitation, Louise. It is great to be here at University Bookstore, as I understand it is called, the bookstore. I love any place that can just refer to the bookstore. Works. And I also am delighted to be here in this church. This is terrific. So I appreciate Pastor Rich giving us this opportunity. I'll tell you a little bit about how this book starts. This book is my story, and it starts with me when I'm 12 years old. Now, I was a late-in-life baby, as they used to be referred to back then, and my mother always called me the surprise. I was about 30 before I figured out what that meant. By the time I was 12 years old, all three of my older brothers, I have three much older brothers, were all in the military, so they were all away from home. And like a lot of families in America, we had our ups and downs through the years. But at the point when the book starts, my father had been selling carpeting. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, always had been. And then my daddy had a heart attack. And it meant a really long time in the hospital and then without not working. And the bills piled up, medical bills. We lost the family station wagon, and we were right on the edge of losing our home. And the book starts with what I think of as the day I grew up. The day I walked into my mother's and daddy's bedroom, and my mother had pulled her best dress out of the closet, and it was an older dress. She'd had it probably 10 or 15 years. And she was struggling to zip it up. And but she finally got the zipper pulled up. She was crying. She wiped her eyes, blew her nose, put on her high heels, and walked over to the Sears to apply for a minimum wage job. She was 50 years old. And She got a minimum wage job, which at this point in time was enough to keep a family of three afloat, because America set a minimum wage at a point where someone worked, kept a family out of poverty. And so that's what my mom did. It was a rocky time for us. Now, this book is a firsthand account of what I lived and what I saw up close and personal. It tells the thread of my story, but in my view, it also tells the thread of America's story. I am the daughter of a maintenance man who ended up in the United States Senate. And sure, I worked hard, but I never forget the fact that I grew up in an America that was building opportunities for kids like me. So here's how I see this. Coming out of the Great Depression, America made two fundamental decisions, and they are remarkable decisions because they are not decisions that had been made elsewhere or that we had made before. The first was that we put strong rules in place to help level the playing field. It was all about having a cop on the beat. No one should be able to steal your purse on Main Street or your pension on Wall Street. So the basic idea was about safety. Over time, it also was about safe drinking water, about safe medicine, and eventually about safe toasters. That was decision number one, a cop on the beat. The second was America built a future for kids. It built a future by investing in education so that kids could get out there and learn more, earn more, produce more. It also invested in roads and bridges, in power grids. Why? Because nobody knew what the next great business idea was going to be, who was going to start the next great business. But we were all pretty sure they were going to need to be able to plug in and get power. They were all going to need to be able to have roads to get their goods to market. And they were all going to need workers who were well educated. So we made those investments together so that whoever had the great idea, whoever was willing to work for it, could get out there and do it, but could help produce more, something that would benefit us all. And the third investment we made, this one is an extraordinary one, and it speaks to something fundamental about who we are as a people. We decided to invest in ideas, in research. We decided to invest in medical research and scientific research and engineering research. We invested in research on the idea that if we built a big pipeline of ideas, our kids and our grandkids would have opportunities that we could barely dream of. So that's what we did. For 50 years, we made those investments. And here's the deal. They worked. They fundamentally worked. So as our families got richer, our country got richer, and as our country got richer, our families got richer. This is the time when America built a great middle class. And then, about 30 years ago, the Republicans started pushing for a different approach. First move, take the cops off the beat. Not off Main Street, off Wall Street. Let the big banks load up on risks. Let them paint a bullseye on the backsides of every American family. Make the word deregulation the mantra of the day. That was step one. And step two, cut taxes for those at the top. Open up huge tax loopholes for big corporations. Cut taxes for billionaires and for millionaires. And how are we going to pay for all those tax cuts? Easy, by cutting investments. Investments in education, investments in infrastructure, investments in medical research and scientific research. And what was the result? Well, banks and other big corporations made huge profits. Billionaires kept more of their money. In other words, the rich got richer and the powerful got more powerful. Meanwhile, the middle class began to crumble. The economy crashed, and our kids may be the first kids in American history to do worse than their parents did. Now, in 2009, after the crash, I was in Washington, and I was working hard on two things. One was to try to bring a little accountability to the bank bailout. And it was hand-to-hand combat. And I talk about that. I have a whole chapter about this in the book. But the other was to fight to try to get a consumer agency. I wanted a level playing field, and I wanted this agency to be part of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms. Now, this next part's really going to surprise you. The big banks hated that idea. I know you're shocked. I know, it's the whole face, right? Who knew? So they hated it. And let me tell you how I know they hated it. I know it two ways. The first way I know that they hated it was they said so, pretty publicly. In fact, they said, and I've got the great footnotes in here, they would kill the agency. So that part has been made clear. And the second way I know is that they spent more than $1 million a day for more than a year in just lobbying expenses to kill off the financial reforms and, in particular, the little consumer agency. So I'm going to pick the story up again, and here's where I'm going to pick it up. Remember, this is 2009. The Democrats still have control of both the House and the Senate. So the bill starts out, financial reform starts out in the House. And at the point I pick up here, it has just made it through the House and has been sent over. The bill has been sent over to the Senate. And the big financial reform bill has as one of its features the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The banks are not yet worried. They're going to kill that little agency while it's over in the Senate. So here's where I pick up the story again. It was Friday morning, January 15th, 2010, and the calls started coming in early. I was at home, up early, working out on the treadmill in the basement, and I was still huffing and puffing when the phone rang for the first time. Had I seen this morning's Wall Street Journal? The rumors were flying on Capitol Hill. The consumer agency wasn't going to make it. Senator Dodd, in an effort to move the larger financial reform bill forward, Senator Dodd would trade it off. There might be some face-saving attempt to set up a new consumer protection department somewhere else in government, but there would be no strong, independent agency with the authority to get much of anything done. The insiders sent the word out. Too bad, so sorry, it was a good idea. But unless the agency was dropped from the reform bill, the whole package of legislation would fail. Better to toss the consumer agency overboard and get the rest of the reforms through. I listened. So this was it. The consumer agency was dead. All the families had been cheated by big banks and the credit card companies. All the hard work by Barney, the consumer groups, Heather, Dan, the president. All that knocking on doors and all those meetings. And now it was coming to an end. So I asked if there would be a vote, even a losing vote. But the answer was no. The death wouldn't be a public execution. Instead, the Senate Banking Committee would propose a financial reform bill with no consumer agency in it. No one in the Senate, not a single Democrat or a single Republican, would ever have to vote against the agency. Instead, it would just be suffocated quietly in its crib. No one would ever know exactly who killed it or why. So I ask my last question. When? How long before the locked-in version of the bill would be introduced in the Senate Banking Committee, with or without the consumer agency? Best estimate? 3 weeks. The deal wasn't finalized, and there were still a lot of other moving pieces that needed to be worked out. So I called Dan. Now, Dan is my former student who appears much in this book and kind of my wingman in Washington. I called Dan and I said, Dan, we've got 3 weeks. Because the way I saw it, we had nothing to lose. I didn't want a job in the Capitol, so what did I care if I ticked off a lot of people in Washington? This was our last chance to get the agency passed into law. If we lost now, we lost forever. We had very little information about what had led to the latest assault on the agency, but we did know one thing. The Senate did not want a tough vote on this issue. Dan explained what that meant. The consumer agency was popular, and to a lot of senators, a vote on the new agency meant having to choose between angering the public and angering the banks. And they didn't want to do either. They preferred a quiet and slightly mysterious death for the consumer agency. So I figured, too bad, too damn bad. If a bunch of senators were going to pick the banks over the families, then the American public had a right to know. And if we didn't win, at least we could raise one hell of a stink. So that's what happens next in the book.
We'll be back in a moment with more of this talk by Senator Elizabeth Warren. Her new book is A Fighting Chance. Coming up, consumer protection for 400 Alex, the senator's office trailer, and spending our money in alignment with our values. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
923-94.9 KUOW. How well can you ever really know the people around you? Tomorrow night, stories of neuroscientists, primatologists, actors, zookeepers, and fathers who are all trying to get inside another's mind, including how a newborn sees his dad and a rare disorder that turns family members into imposters. The Who Are You edition of Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Lows around 50 tonight, mostly clear. Friday highs around 70 and sunny. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Goodwill, a recycler, helping keep reusable goods out of landfills by offering those items in the stores to fund job training programs for individuals with barriers to employment. Goodwill, because jobs change lives.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Our guest is Senator Elizabeth Warren. Journalist Jill Lepore says of Warren, her brief is really about the abandonment of children, not by women who go to school or to work, but by legislatures and courts that have allowed the nation's social and economic policies to be made by corporations and bankers. Next up, a rigged game in Washington and how Warren intends to fix it.
So here's what I see, and here's what I talk about in these experiences as I ended up in Washington, often quite inadvertently, talking about the fights I got into. And do understand, spoiler alert on this, I lose a lot of these fights, but not all of them. But what I saw is that Washington works well for those who can hire armies of lobbyists and lawyers. It just doesn't work so well for everyone else. I saw it with the big banks. They cheated American families, they crashed the economy, they got bailed out, and now, today, the big five banks are 38% bigger than they were back in 2008. Think about that. A kid gets caught with a few ounces of pot and goes to jail, but a big bank breaks the law for years by laundering drug money, and nobody even gets arrested. The game is rigged, and it's not right. That's what this book is about. And now, let me just double down on the point, because it's not just the big banks. Look at the choices the federal government makes today. Our college kids are getting crushed by student loan debt. We need to rebuild our roads and our bridges and our power grids. We need more investment in medical research and scientific research. But instead of building a future, This country is bleeding billions of dollars in tax loopholes and subsidies that go to rich and profitable corporations. Fortune 500 companies, profitable companies, pay zero in taxes. Billionaires get so many tax loopholes that they pay at lower rates than their secretaries. But they have lobbyists. Lobbyists and lawyers and lots of Republican friends in Washington to protect every loophole and every privilege. We have to face it. The game is rigged. The rich and the powerful can protect themselves, can rewrite the rules so that over and over and over, the rules get tilted just a little more, just a little more, just a little more to protect them. And everyone else, not so much. So, we can whine about this, we can whimper about this, or we can fight back. Me, I'm planning to fight back. And that is what this book is all about. This book is about the fact that the game is rigged and that it's up to us to fix it. Now, I want to say one more thing about this. Change is hard. And when you're up against organized money and organized power, it is really hard. Hard, but possible. That little Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we got it passed in the law. We got it done. And before you leave here saying, I cannot believe I am such a nerd that I was clapping for the establishment of a new consumer agency, I want to remind you why that little agency is worth clapping for. It's been in effect in place for just a little over 2 years now. And already, it has forced the largest financial institutions in this country to return more than $3 billion directly to families they cheated. That's when government works. That's when government works. So, the way I see this is I'm not ready to turn this country over to rich corporations, to powerful individuals, and to their army of lobbyists. One of the ways I fight back is through books. I believe in books. This is not my first book. Although I have to say, the book party for Secured Transactions, A Systems Approach, yeah, was a little smaller. But do understand, I wrote this book out of gratitude. Gratitude to my mother and father, who worked hard all their lives, who died with very little, except the knowledge that their four kids were doing better than they did. I wrote this book out of gratitude to an America that invested in kids, that believed in opportunity, that put money and resources behind that so that we could build a future for not just for some of our kids, but for all of our kids. And I wrote this book out of a fierce determination that this is our moment in history, and we will not turn away from it. It is our moment when we decide what kind of a people we are and what kind of a country we are going to build. And I believe that together we will build the kind of country where every kid gets a fighting chance. So that's what it's about for me. Thank you. So we now have our official question and asker, right?
Hello.
Hello. And I will take consumer protection for 400, please, Alex. Don't you think? That's what I want. I want like a big board of this. Okay. All right. I'm ready.
Okay. Hi. Okay. First, let me just say I'm Saya Emerson. I'm the assistant manager of the book department at University Bookstore.
Good to see you, Saya.
Thank you. And it is so, so wonderful to hear you say that you believe in books. Thank you for inspiring all of us tonight. First question. What should the average person be doing to support financial reforms? And this is a two-part.
Okay.
How should we best lobby for the return of Glass-Steagall,
yes,
lessening derivatives,
yes,
high-frequency trading, etc.?
Okay. So I love questions like this. So let me do Glass-Steagall first. For those of you who aren't totally up on your financial nerdiness, let me remind you what happened. So, I'll start this story in 1794, but I'll tell it fast, okay? So roughly, about every 15 years, America used to have a bust, right? We'd have booms and then we'd have busts. We'd have booms and then we'd have busts. And the financial system would just completely fall apart, melt down, people lose all their money, all that sort of thing. We hit the 1930s and we said, we can do better than this. We can put some regulations in place. I talked partly about that, put a cop on the beat. We can watch out for that. And the second thing we said we're going to do is, you know, banking should not be so exciting. It should not be an exciting event. So what we're going to do is we're going to separate banking, your checking account, your savings account, from Wall Street and other forms of risk taking, and build a nice strong wall between the two. And the wall was called Glass-Steagall. And then what happened, you can guess. The smaller banks, the credit unions, they were fine with this. But as some of the financial institutions got bigger, they kept pecking at the wall. And they pecked at the wall because they wanted to be able to take some of your nice savings and some of your nice checking account money and go gamble it on Wall Street, because they figured they could make more money doing that. And it's true. They probably could if they take those risks. In the boom times, it works really well. And do understand, on the other side, they were pecking on the wall, too. The investment bankers who were saying, boy, we would really love to be able to get to your checking account, your savings account. So both sides keep pecking on the wall. Mostly they get rebuffed until we hit the 1980s. And in the 1980s, the regulators, deregulation is the mantra of the day, begin to open little holes in the wall. And the two find each other. And risks start going up on the banking side of the house. Finally, at the end of the 90s, Glass-Steagall is entirely repealed. And we all know what happens next, right? The banks really load up on the risk. And in 2008, they nearly bombed this economy back into the Stone Age. It is not a story with a happy ending. So as part of the financial reforms, there were many of us who thought a starting place is to put Glass-Steagall back in place. Not because it is the only reform we need, but it is a powerful reform that we need. And would have two effects. One is to reduce the riskiness of the banking part, which means it reduces our need to bail out, because you've got to protect people's savings accounts and checking accounts, not so much whatever they're doing through Wall Street investments. The second thing it would do is it simply would bring down the size, because when you've got these humongous big five, big six, depending on how you want to count, banks, and you break them into their two component parts, at least they are somewhat smaller and somewhat more diversified. So we couldn't get it through in the financial reforms. This is one where that $1 million a day for well over a year paid off. But one of the first bills that I introduced when I got to the United States Senate with, you're going to love these co-sponsors, with John McCain, with Maria Cantwell, and with Angus King, an independent from Maine, was a 21st century Glass-Steagall. So we have it out there. We have the bill pending. And I look at it this way. We wrote this. It is a good, tough version. It accounts for changes in the financial world. You know, you got to kind of write these things a little differently over time. And it's there. Right now, nope, we can't get it to move forward with any speed, but it's there, it's written, it's ready to go. And this brings us to the second part, and that is, what can you do about financial reform? So I'm going to, it's a question that's going to go through everything I talk about now. The way I see the world is that we're playing on a tilted playing field, and the reason is because the rich and the powerful have the advantages of concentrated money, concentrated power, and they just keep getting the rules rewritten in their favor. And every time they're rewritten in their favor, they're not rewritten in favor of everybody else. So it just makes it just a little bit tougher and a little bit tougher. So how do we fight back? That becomes the fundamental question. And the answer has to be, we have to take advantage of what we've got. We got two things on our side that they don't have. We have our voices and we have our votes. And we have got to use them and use them big time. So I'm going to give you a small thing to do about this. If you come out of this and you say, you know, I like this point you make about Glass-Steagall financial reforms or any other part of what we talk about tonight. And I hope we get some questions on some other topics because there are a lot of fights that I'm now involved in Washington and would love to have a chance to talk about. But it's, we got to do something about it. We can't just say, yep, great idea, and say it to the television set. We can't all come in and talk to each other. You know, we kind of get this. It really has to be about how we reach out to our friends who live in other states and get them to go talk to their senators, get them to email their senators. How much we contribute, $5 and $10 to campaigns, how much we sign petitions. You think that stuff doesn't matter? I'm here to tell you, it matters, and it matters big time. That if we use our voices, if we use our votes, if we work collectively, we really can change the direction of this country. I not only believe it, I know it. I know it all the way down. So that's what we're going to have to do on this. We'll talk more about it, but that's it.
Thank you. All right, next question comes from a husband and wife who between them have multiple degrees and $250,000 in student loans. So their question is, what is your strategy to get the student loan bill to pass?
Okay. Oh. So here's the deal on student loans. All right, I want to do this a couple of different ways. So here I was, a baby senator, starting out January, right? January of 2013. And you're going to love this part. I didn't have an office. They put me in a trailer. This is a long and complicated story about the Senate moves on Senate standard time. So it took, we had 12 newcomers in our hearing, 12 senators, obviously, who left. It stayed at 100. It took 7 months for the Senate to decide who was going to have what office as we move forward. But there I was sitting in my trailer thinking about, I'm a senator now, I'm living large. And okay, so I got to tell you this story. So I had been a senator for like an hour and a half when the security people come to tell you all the things that can happen now that you're a senator and what to do about them. So it was things like, so if you see a green gas coming through your air vents, I'm not kidding you, it was grab your, they keep this helmet thing in your drawer, and he made me put it on so I'd know how to put it on. And they go through all this, if you hear gunfire, lock your door. I'm not kidding. So they go through everything, fire, pestilence, flood, all the things. And he's checking off his list. So the three of them sitting there, he checks off. He's very sober about this. And I'm like, really? Every time he goes through one, I mean, really? By the time he hits item number 14, I'm rethinking the whole Senate thing. And so finally he looks at me, he says, I'm to the last item on my list. And he said, tornadoes. I said, yeah. And he said, so, he said, you will be pleased to know that the Capitol and the Senate office buildings are built with, you know, 14-inch thick walls with steel reinforcement and, you know, Thor's hammer, you know, in the middle of it. And so he goes on and on about, you know, and it's strong, and it's, and he said, so, he said, the official advice to senators is shelter in place. And he looks at me and says, you, however, live in a trailer. And I said, yes. And he said, my advice to you, run. So I'm sitting in my office thinking about this, living large, like I said. And the first bill I ever proposed, I walked down on the Senate floor and laid it down, and it was to say that students should be able to borrow money at the Fed discount window the same way the largest financial institutions do, for the same little fraction of a penny. Now, I really believe that's true. But the point I wanted to make is that every time we lend money to anybody, if we are doing it at below cost, we are making an investment. And as between the biggest financial institutions and our students, I would like to make the investment at least on an equal basis with our students. Now, I did that bill. I didn't think anybody would actually, well, I shouldn't say I didn't think anybody. I thought everybody would rise up and say that makes so much sense. But I got 19 people who voted for that ultimately on that bill. Didn't win, but this time around, we got a new bill. And here's the new bill. So for all of you, and by the way, co-sponsors include Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. So got our women out there making it happen. Part of the reason I am happy to be in Washington is on this bill. And here's what the bill proposes. It says that we're going to take the, listen to me on these numbers, the $1.2 trillion outstanding in student loan debt. Think about that. 40 million Americans are on the hook right now for student loan debt. We're going to take that money and we're going to refinance it down to a lower interest rate. Now, that may not sound like a lot by itself, but I just want to tell you a little bit about the realities about where that money is right now. Right now, if you have a home, most of you know, in this current low interest rate environment, you can refinance and get a lower interest rate. Businesses have already refinanced down to a much lower interest rate. Townships, municipalities have refinanced. Students don't have that opportunity. So if you got a student loan a few years ago and got hit at the 7% interest rate, 8%, 9%, just wave when I hit your number, 10%, 11%, okay, and it keeps on going. People are stuck in those loans. And now here comes the genuinely shocking part about this. So we've got people trapped in these high interest loans. Guess what that does for the U.S. budget? The federal government is making tens of billions of dollars in profits off the student loan program. Just the cohort of loans from 2007 to 2012, just that little slice, is on target to make $66 billion in profits for the United States government. That's after the bad debt losses, after the administrative costs, after the cost of funds. Think about that. So here's what the bill proposes. The bill says we're going to refinance down to the interest rates that the Republicans just agreed to last year. Everybody voted on it. Majority of Democrats and all of the basically all the Republicans voted for, which is 3.86% for undergrad loans, a little bit higher for graduate student loans. We're going to refinance all that debt down. And how are we going to plug the hole in the budget? The answer is we're going to close up the tax loopholes and pass the Buffett rule. So this is the right thing to do for students, but this is the strongest reminder that I can make. When we decide how we're going to spend our money as a country, we can spend billions of dollars in tax loopholes for billionaires, or we can spend billions of dollars to bring down the interest rate. Do understand, the government actually at 3.86% still makes a profit. It's just a whole lot smaller profit. And the number I picked because the Republicans had already voted for it earlier. It's the reminder, this is about economics, yep. It's about power, yep. but it is about values, and we need to spend our money in alignment with our values. So the way I see this is we got a choice right in front of us on this bill. We've got more than 30 Democratic co-sponsors already in the Senate, and there is a choice that we're going to put to the Senate, and a choice that I hope everybody in America sees. As a country, we can decide to invest in billionaires, in people who've already made it, or we can decide to take dollar for dollar exactly that same money and invest in people who are trying to get a start in life. That's what this is going to be about. So, we're going to get there on this one. Let me just say one more thing about this, because I feel so strongly about this. This is the one, again, we have got to make our voices heard on this. The difference between this just happens in Washington and on the floor, and this happens because people across this country pay attention, because they insist that we talk about this as a country, is huge. So when you leave here, Bank on Students. That's the title of the bill. Go Google it. Go sign one of the petitions. Being able to stand up and talk about how many people have said to the United States Senate, to the House of Representatives, this is the bill we want. It makes a difference. And understand this. We make them vote on it. We make them vote on it. We make them vote on it. And if they want to vote for billionaires and vote against students, then let them do it in a very public way, just like with the consumer agency, and then go home and explain it to the people who elected them. That's how we make this work.
Stay tuned for more from Senator Elizabeth Warren on Speaker's Forum. After the break, advice for young women about public service and the power of the Pinky Promise. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
948 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow evening on Livewire, David Kinney, author of The Dylanologists, Adventures in the Land of Bob, also TV, stand-up, festival, and podcasting comedian Cameron Esposito, actor John Kim of Neighbors, The Pacific, and The Librarians, and music from Seattle band Lamolo. All recorded with a live audience in Portland, Oregon. That's tomorrow evening at 8. Lows around 50 tonight, says the forecast for the Seattle area. Mostly clear. Friday highs around 70 and sunny skies. Two-time Grammy Hall of Fame jazz and pop vocalist Johnny Mathis talks about what lies behind his enduring success, samples his extensive catalog of recordings, and sings a couple songs while he's at it on Song Travels, beginning in a few minutes. At 10 o'clock.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, this is part 3 of today's Speaker's Forum with Senator Elizabeth Warren. We'll hear next about a call from Senator Patty Murray, efforts to save Social Security, and the prospect of amending the Constitution. Warren's new book is A Fighting Chance.
This is a question from Catherine Sims. What is your advice to young women hoping to have a career in public service?
Okay, Catherine, what is my advice to young women who want to have a career in public service? The answer is just do it. Someone's already used that slogan. I didn't run for anything. I never run for public office. I hadn't done the, you know, kind of, you get in there and you run for city council and then you're right and do all those things. So this was a pretty shocking notion to me. Patty Murray was the person who was recruiting persons to run for the United States Senate. And she called me and she said, I think I'll run for the United States Senate. And I did, I'll be blunt, what a lot of women do. I said, oh, but you know, there are things I don't know, and there's this, and there's that, and kind of kept explaining. You know, my resume doesn't have an address, and I didn't have this particular experience and that qualification. Patty listens for my phone, and she says, oh, please. She said, men never ask if they're qualified. They just say, how much money will you raise me? So I'll tell you something I did. Once I decided to run, one of the first things I noticed was there were little girls who showed up. And I mean, sometimes little tiny, sometimes bigger than tiny, but little girls who showed up at various campaign events. They'd show up. And I made a point early on. Every single time I saw a little girl, I'd seek her out. And I always got down on her level. You can always tell a teacher. And I would say, my name is Elizabeth. I'm running for the United States Senate because that's what girls do. You bet. And then we do pinky promises so that we would remember. We have lots of pictures of pinky promises. We got another one?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want it.
Yeah, I'm
okay.
Ready.
In 1986, Social Security was fixed for the next 75 years by Reagan and Greenspan. What happened?
Now, let's haul Reagan and Greenspan in here to talk about that. So here's the deal in Social Security. I make a couple of points on Social Security. Social Security has been changed 30-plus times through the years because the country changes. People live longer, the number of women working shifts, how much people earn, kind of the curves change. And until the 80s, these were pretty non-controversial changes. The demographers would come in and they'd show you how the numbers were running, and you kind of would, you'd adjust the tax on Social Security to get it right so that Social Security would be secure forever and would be able to pay at what inflation adjusted would be about the same amount of money. And when we hit it the last time in the 80s, part of the mistake, in my view, was to ever describe it as it is fixed. No, it's fixed until we have more information about what's happening, about how long people live and so on. But the other one was that we did inflation adjust on the revenue side. So the benefits kept going up with inflation, but the cap on how much of your income would be subject to Social Security didn't move. And I just pointed out as a math problem, it's not a policy proposal, it's just a math problem, that if it had adjusted for inflation, we wouldn't be having any problems with Social Security. They just would have moved together. And, you know, it's not that you wouldn't have to tinker a little bit around the edges, but basically it would all work. So here's the deal. Now it's gotten caught in this political web. And it goes back once again to a fundamental question about who we are as a people and what it is we believe in. Me, I believe we have got to solve this problem. We have got to not only make sure that Social Security is there and that it works for the rest of, what is our timeline that we can see, but basically for the rest of this century. But it is also time, now that we are caught in a terrible retirement crisis, remember the other parts of what happens in retirement. We now live in a world where the defined benefit plan is disappearing, something that was there still back in the 70s and into the 80s. We live in a world where families have been under such financial stress for so long that they have been unable to save. Just keep in mind, the median family in 1971 was able to put away about 11% of their take-home pay in savings. The median family by 2001 was putting away zero and was, in fact, head over heels in debt. And we have watched the number one retirement plan in America, which was pay off your house and live on your Social Security, disappear with the bottoming out of the housing market. That now is a moment when we have to think not only about how we stabilize Social Security going forward to make sure it's there for everyone who has paid in, but how it is we think about those payments so that we readjust them so that for the 14 million Americans for whom Social Security is all that stands between them and poverty, for those who most depend on it, that Social Security payments will be increased, and that we will have the ability in the United States to say to everyone, after a lifetime of work, you can retire with dignity, because that's the kind of country we are. So that's what I believe.
Okay, I have one final question.
One final question. Make it a good one. They're
do you know,
restless down here.
Do you know about our state initiative 1329?
Whoa! Uh-huh. Yes.
Seeking to join 16 other states that have already passed such a resolution. to reduce the influence of big money in elections, and to clarify that the Bill of Rights is for people, not artificial entities like corporations.
Right. Okay. Yes. So let me start this by saying, after being a law professor for more than 25 years, the idea of amending the United States Constitution sort of makes my eyelashes get frizzy. I mean, it's not a place I want to go. But the United States Supreme Court has given us no choice. We are going to have to amend the Constitution. And now what I want to do is I just want to angle off that to say it and say it as bluntly as I can. Money has a corrupting influence. And we can never fix it perfectly. But the Supreme Court has taken us so far out of line that we, the people, have got to push back. I wrote this book, as I said earlier, out of gratitude, but also out of determination. So I want to say tonight how grateful I am to every one of you for showing up here, for showing up to talk about a book, for showing up to talk about ideas, for showing up to think about, just for an evening, what kind of a people we are and what kind of a country we're going to build going forward. One of the things that's clear in this book, if you get a chance to read it, is I didn't set my path. There was no secret desire somewhere in my heart that someday I would be a YouTube star with someone on the other end of a pointed stick. There was nowhere in here that there was a secret desire to do anything other than the one thing I announced right at the beginning. I always wanted to be a teacher. That's what I've wanted to do all my life. But this is our moment in history. And I'm not going to let this moment pass and say, I turned the other way when the big corporations just took over this country. That I turned the other way when money and influence in Washington meant that we write a set of rules that don't work for America's families. They just work for those who already have power and privilege. And so I wrote this book as a way to fight back. But I go around and do my best to talk to people about this book because I really hope that you'll be part of this fight. The only way that our kids are going to have a future, that our grandkids are going to have a future, is if we talk about our values, if we use our voices, if we use our votes. So thank you for being here tonight, but more than anything else, please be part of this fight. This is how we're going to win, and it's the only way. Thank you.
You've been listening to Senator Elizabeth Warren. If not on the campaign trail, she is on the road with her new book, A Fighting Chance. Senator Warren spoke at Seattle's University Temple United Methodist Church on May 29, 2014. The event was sponsored by University Bookstore. To listen again to this talk or pass it along to a friend, navigate over to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. And while you're there, please let us know what upcoming talks you'd like us to feature. For Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Just a few seconds before 10, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Support for KUOW comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Later tonight, a conversation with the Vancouver resident who won the women's section of the grueling Comrades Marathon in South Africa. That's part of As It Happens tonight at 11. Lows around 50 tonight, mostly clear. Friday highs around 70 degrees, sunny skies. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.